contacting the Alaska Native Review Commission, and maybe I could just say a little bit about that at the start. I was asked by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, that's an international organization of Eskimos from Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, to come to Alaska and to hold meetings for Alaska Native people and Alaskans generally around the state to see what the impact of ANCSA, of the land claim settlement of 1971, had been, to see how people viewed the performance of their corporations, to look at the issues relating to 1991, sale of shares, taxation of land, the question whether the children born since 1971 should have been included in the settlement, questions of sovereignty and native self-government have come up everywhere we've been. The World Council of Indigenous Peoples is the co-sponsor of this commission. The World Council of Indigenous Peoples is an international organization of Indian tribes from North and South America, and it includes indigenous peoples from other countries as well. I am from Canada, and I was a lawyer for Native people in Canada in the 1960s, and I represented the Nisga'a tribe of northwest British Columbia. During the 1970s, I was a judge in Canada, and I held a commission in the Canadian Arctic that took me to the Canadian Arctic and subarctic for 3 years, where I held hearings in all the Native communities and heard from experts from all over the world to consider northern land claims and environmental issues and question whether a pipeline should be built in our own country. And during the 70s, I came to Alaska, and many Alaskans came to Canada to testify before me. And so when I resigned as a judge about a year ago, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference asked me to come here and hold these meetings and these hearings throughout the state. We've already held meetings at Amonik and Tununik, two Eskimo villages on the Bering Sea. We've been to Copper Center and Gulkana in the Otna region. The Alaska Native students at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks asked the commission to come there so they could make their presentations. And about 35 students did make presentations to the commission. We went to downtown Fairbanks and held meetings there for 3 days, and about 75 people altogether in the Fairbanks area testified. We went to Juneau and to Sitka and to Angoon last week, and we held meetings at Ketchikan and Saxman this week, and we're going to be here today, this afternoon, and this evening, and again tomorrow afternoon, and then we will be going down to Heidelberg, I believe, tomorrow, late tomorrow afternoon, and spending the evening there. And then we're going to Metlakatla on Saturday. So this is an opportunity for people like yourselves at meetings like these to express your views about ANCSA, about enrollment, about dividends, about shares, about sale of shares in 1991, about taxation of land, and questions of sovereignty and self-government. It's an opportunity for Alaska Natives to decide where they go from here. Now, everything, when you come to testify, I hope you won't mind coming forward and just sitting here at this table with me at this microphone, so that everything you say can be recorded by Jeff Berliner, who's seated behind me, and a transcript will be made of everything that's said. And that means that when I write my report, and my report will be made public in the summer of 1985, it'll be based, what I write will be based on what you say at meetings like this, and that is why we have a permanent record being kept of all that is said. I think you know Mary Kenswick, who's seated over by the window, who is working with our commission and helped to organize the meetings here in South-Southeast. And my wife, Beverly, who's seated with Judy, is traveling with me. And if you don't mind, I've appointed her photographer for our commission, and if she gets a real nice salary for that. She gets room and board when we're on the road, and I think that's all she gets. But if you don't mind, she may take one or two photographs during the course of the afternoon. And I think that's about all I should say. We'll be here this afternoon and this evening for people who come in and want to testify, and again tomorrow afternoon. And so we're open for business, and we'd like to hear from you.
I'm not too sure on how to address you, so I'll just refer to you as Your Honor. Well, my purpose will become clear here in a moment. My name is Woodrow Morrison, Jr. I'm 42 years old, a Haida from Heidelberg, Alaska. Just in the way of a little background, I have a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Minnesota in economics and also in sociology, and a Juris Doctorate from the University of New Mexico. As far as I know, I may be one of the only Haidas with a law degree. Also, at present, I'm serving on the Heidelberg City Council as a council member, on the board of directors for the Haida Corporation, and on the executive vice president of the company. I spent some time in Interior Alaska in the Doyon region as a member of the executive committee for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and also the president and chairman of the board of Dina Aka, a corporation set up to handle all the SIDA programs for the Doyon region, and also a corporate officer for the Koyukon Kuskokwim, well, it's called the Koyukon Development Corporation, was for all the rural CAP programs in the Doyon region, and also served with the Lower Yukon Fish and Game Advisory Board for game regulations up in the Lower Yukon region. And I spent a period of 2 years working for Alaska Federation of Natives, 1 year prior to it being incorporated, and then another time after it was incorporated. But since then, I've been working in Heidelberg for the Haida Corporation, which is a Ananska Village Corporation. The Native Claims Settlement Act is not a settlement. They have not settled with us. The Claims Act refers to us as natives, and most people probably don't know where the beginnings of the use of that term came from. And I have a copy that I can leave with you of the proceedings of the Board of Indian Commissioners at the 13th Lake Mohawk Conference, Indian Conference, first session, Wednesday, October 9th, 1895, an address by Dr. Sheldon Jackson. And he stated that, "I come to represent Alaska. We have no Indians in Alaska. We have natives. When Alaska began to develop, some wise men said, 'What are you going to do with the natives? Do you want reservations?' And the answer was no. Do you want agents? No. Do you want these people sheltered behind the Indian policy of the government? No. We do not want any Indian government at all. What do you want then? We want citizenship right from the start, and that people should simply be called natives. It was at first a constant fight to keep from being called Indians. We wanted to avail ourselves of the experience of the past on the Indian question, and so we have no Indians, we have only natives. The natives have all the rights of that any white man has. There has never been a time since the establishment of courts in that land when a native could not go into court, could not sue and be sued like any white man. That's a bald-faced lie. Dr. Sheldon Jackson was probably one of the most dictatorial people ever to, or people were, I guess you might say, unfortunate to meet. When Sheldon Jackson was appointed as a commissioner for education in Alaska, one of the first policies he laid out was requiring that Indian children be signed over to him for 5 years when attending the Sitka Training School. And he used the U.S. Treasury agent to force parents to bring their children to school. If they didn't, they were threatened with prison imprisonment. So anyway, that gives you some idea as to why we're called natives, is that it was designed right from the very beginning by the missionaries that we would not have any Indian policy, that we would not come under any protection from the United States government. And as you can see, as we go down the road, that those policies are in effect today. And I say that they did not settle with us because the United States government, for one thing, did not have any right to settle with us, nor did they have any authority. But they do have a moral and legal obligation to settle with us. In going back through the documents present that in the United States libraries, there are quite a number of documents that show that the United States of Alaska did not purchase Alaska. The United States government purchased trading rights from the Imperial Russian government. I have a copy of a memorandum dated November 21st, 1867. This memorandum was from Mr. Clay to Mr. Seward, Legation of the United States, St. Petersburg. In this, the Russian Imperial Court said, "Sir, I herein transmit to you a memorandum descriptive of the Russian Imperial System of Russian America, Division of Property, etc., marked AA." And in this memorandum, the Russians disclaim ever having asserted any dominion whatsoever over Haidas. Now, they do mention that they did assert dominion over certain groups of people, but they were very, very limited. And also, I guess we are the ones referred to as the uncivilized tribes. We refuse to be Christianized. Also, the people of Heidelberg, in a lot of ways, have been sold a bill of goods. We've been told that our elders chose in 1911 to move from the principal villages of Tlinquan, Haukan, Koyantlas, and Sakwan to Heidelberg to get a school. However, historical documents prove that this was not the case. In a publication called The Sketches of an Excursion to Southeastern Alaska by Reverend A. L. Lindsay, D.D., I assume that's the Doctor of Divinity, in 1881. The report says, in the spring of 1880, Mr. Young, accompanied by the Reverend G.W. Lyons, the newly appointed missionary to Sitka, made the tour of the Prince of Wales group of islands. He visited all the tribes in that region, taking the census and collecting information as before. He located a mission in Cordova Bay, selecting a site for another mission town at a point accessible by four Haida villages, where there was good water power, plenty of timber, valuable timber, a good anchorage, and ground capable of cultivation. He obtained pledges from the headmen of all the villages that they would desert their present Indian towns and build a new town on the site selected. He recommended to the board that this mission site be started on what was known as the Metlakatla Plan. First, a sawmill, which would soon pay for itself, the Indians readily buying the lumber, the church and schoolhouse built by native workmen properly directed, then a town of neat and commodious houses built and filled by a population which subscribes to the laws and conforms to the plans of the settlement. The board adopted Mr. Young's recommendations, and now that field is outlined and ready for a suitable manager to take charge of what can be made in a few years an entirely self-supporting plantation. That's their words. Then in 1890, taking this in chronological order, the 51st Congress House Report, first session, this is 1890, June 14th, report number 2495, parenthetically to accompany Senate 1859. Doll Island, being about 2 miles wide and perhaps 40 miles long, and Long Island, being about 2 miles wide and 10 miles long, are occupied by what is known as the Haida tribe of Indians. These islands possess unusual facilities for supplying the natives with canoe timber upon which this tribe has depended for many years. And to such a degree of perfection have they attained in their manufacture that they have a wide reputation among the white and native people of southeastern Alaska for their seagoing qualities. On these islands, different quantities of game exist, and there are innumerable streams in which fish abound in large numbers and upon which these natives have entirely depended for their food and fish supply for generations. The location of these islands, being almost at the lower extremity of Alaska, immediately bordering British Columbia, and of such close proximity thereto that the natives trespass upon these grounds for the purpose of obtaining fish and canoe timber, thus depriving the natives in United States territory of supplies that should of right be reserved for their use. We therefore recommend that these two islands be reserved for these natives, subject to such rules and regulations as may be prescribed by the Secretary of Interior. So then we get up to Dr. Sheldon Jackson in 1895 when he says we have no natives, no Indians, we have only natives. Then in 1911, a letter from the Department of Interior, Bureau of Education, Alaska Division, Seattle, Washington, dated July 24, 1911, to C.W. Hawksworth from Mr. Lupp, Chief of the Division of Alaska. And in this letter is some of the same language that was in the report of 1880 or 1881, referring to what the Indians can do if properly directed, and also the Metlakatla plan. It says, from Seattle, you will proceed to Ketchikan and confer with any Tlinquan natives who may be there and ascertain how many, if any, desire to attempt the establishment of a new village. While at Ketchikan, you will, if possible, also visit Metlakatla for the purpose of making a study of what Indians can do if properly directed. And then it goes on to instruct him to encourage and help them in every way possible. So the setting up of the mission school in Cordova Bay at Haukan in 1880 was merely setting the stage for later, 30 years later, 1910, 1911, for clearing the land of our people so that others could come in and take it. As the situation is now, the village of Haukan is on Long Island. The only people owning property in that village site is the Presbyterian Church. Most of the rest of the village of the island is now owned by Tlaquan Village Corporation from up near Haines. Then, after the community of Heidelberg was settled in 1911, 12, and 13, well, in 1913, the Alaska Territorial Legislature enacted a session law which permitted white communities to incorporate as cities of the second class, but prohibited by de facto native communities from incorporating and also keeping them from incorporating until 1915. In 1915, the territorial legislature then enacted legislation that would permit native communities to incorporate. At the same time, they enacted another session law, which was referred to as Chapter 24, to define and establish the political status of certain Native Indians within the territory of Alaska. And in this law, it lays out very specifically what Natives had to do to become citizens of the United States. The primary thrust of this particular piece of legislation was to break up the family ties. and to break all tribal relationships, and also that once an Indian had shown that he had broken all tribal relationships and could find five white men to appear in court with him to attest to the fact that this person had abandoned all tribal customs and relationship and have adopted the ways and habits of a civilized life, then the person was eligible for citizenship. But also within that law contained other aspects of it that caused 28 men from Heidelberg to sign a statement, and I'll read it. "We, the undersigned Alaska Natives of Heidelberg, Alaska, hereby declare that we have given up our old tribal relationships, that we recognize no chief of clan or tribal family, that we have given up all claim to or interest in tribal and communal houses, that we live in one family houses in accordance with the customs of civilization, that we observe the marriage laws of the United States, that our children take the name of the father and belong equally to the father and mother, and that the rights of the maternal uncle to direct the children are no longer recognized, and that in the case of death of either parent, we recognize the laws of the United States relative to inheritance of property, that we have discarded the totem and recognize the stars and stripes as our only emblem, and that we are a self-supporting and law-abiding people. We therefore believe we have fulfilled all requirements necessary to citizenship in the United States, and we respectfully request the Congress of the United States to pass a law granting us the full rights of citizenship. The first name on there is my grandfather's, Paul Dell Morrison." So people were forced into a situation where they had no choice but to try to become citizens, because during the gold rush of 1898, the whites began pouring into our country, taking over our communities, and the only protection were the missionaries. Our people asked Congress to protect us from their people. Congress's response each time was, "You're not citizens, we can't help you." So in 1924, the United States made us all civilized people by declaring us citizens. In 1929, this law set up for natives to become citizens was repealed. It was found to be unconstitutional, and also permitted native communities to incorporate under general population guidelines rather than specifically native. Now, all this probably doesn't seem like it's going anywhere, but the point here is that prior to these dates, there is very little written documentation of our occupancy of the land. However, the people of the Haidas and the Tlingit people entered into treaties. We know where the boundary is between Tlingit and Haida people, what's our land and what is theirs. We chose to no longer challenge the changing of the boundaries because it wasn't done by Tlingits, it was done by white people. And also, the Claims Settlement Act did not settle with us as a people. They did not come to us and ask us Haidas what we wanted. No one ever discussed it with us. It was done by people who put themselves into power. The Tlingit and Haida Central Council became the paper chiefs of the Haidas and the Tlingits of southeastern Alaska. They were appointed by Congress to speak for us. We did not appoint them. They are the ones who settled for this. We did not. Heidelberg had a reservation established in 1949 of 101,000 acres. And during that period of time, salmon traps were legal. Libby McNeil and Libby had fish traps that were in Heidelberg's, within the Heidelberg Reservation. Heidelberg people tried to tax or charge Libby McNeil for using those trap sites. A court litigation followed. The court found that our reservation was not legally established. The canned salmon industry were the barons of Alaska during that period of time. So then we come to the Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. If you go back and read through the lobbying efforts in Congress, you'll find that some of the major lobbyists for the Native Claims Settlement Act were the oil companies. And find and also read through the records on the lobbying that was done for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Company, you'll find that there were millions, literally millions of dollars were spent on that lobbying effort. But the whole idea was, again, like the missionaries did to us in our villages, clear us out of the way and they can take it. So instead of settling with us, what they did is they settled with the state of Alaska. Haida Corporation does not belong to Haidas. Haida Corporation is an instrument of the state. It's bound by state law, and we have no room to maneuver. It was poorly constructed, but mostly what it was the perpetration of an idea that took white men thousands of years, well, we'll say hundreds of years, to learn about corporations, and they expected us to learn in a very, very, very short period of time about corporations. Just to tell you a little bit about Haida Corporation so that you'll get some feel for what we're faced with. Haida Corporation, well, Heidelberg IRA Council was formed, the first one in Alaska in 1939. Through that, we established the salmon cannery in Heidelberg that ran successfully for a number of years until the Bureau of Indian Affairs stepped in, stripped our equipment, moved it to another location. And we've been in litigation with the Bureau of Indian Affairs for 19, going on 20 years now, over that operation. But in the meantime, it was leased out to the Haida Corporation. The Haida Corporation did not have any money, so they went to the bank, to CFAB, the Commercial and Agricultural Bank, whatever it's called, in Anchorage, to borrow approximately $3 million. The bank required that in exchange for a loan of $3 million that the Haida Corporation put up all of its timber assets as collateral, $34 million worth of assets as collateral for a $3 million loan.
When was this?
In 1980, I believe it was. And so now Haida Corporation is sitting there with enormous debts, with a bank holding a lien on all 23,040 acres of timberland. The seafoods industry went bad in 1982. The company began losing money. It was a crisis situation, and the company was forced to shift its operations over into timber. The seafoods plant was shut down and has not operated since the summer of 1982. Haida Corporation got into a timber operation, like I say, on a crisis situation in the spring of 1983. By June of 1983, the Haida Corporation was involved in major litigation with a contractor, and the decision from the court has not yet been handed down. Major debts were incurred during 1983 to start up a new timber operation. We logged approximately 15 million board feet of timber, and all we did was manage to reduce a small part of the indebtedness. For 1984, the Haida Corporation is planning on logging approximately 20 million board feet of timber. Out of that 20 million board feet of timber, with an average price of $430 per 1,000 board feet, the company expects to make $6.40 per 1,000 board feet out of the 430. The rest is all going to pay debts. The shareholders don't get a nickel out of it. Haida Corporation will have stripped its land of 35 million board feet of timber and not one nickel going back to the shareholders. We've been cornered by bankers, by law firms, by politicians, and then the next saving grace was ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Act, I believe is what it's referred to. Prior to ANSCA and prior to ANILCA, we would go in the springtime to jig for halibut up around Noyes Island and quite a few number of other places without permits. Well, earlier, we'll back up just a bit. In the spring of each year, the herring would spawn. Our people came up to, we call Oostlai, around Craig, to pick herring eggs. There weren't any that we know of right now down near Heidelberg. And so sometime prior to 1920, a man and his wife from the Heidelberg, one of the Heidelberg Haida villages, brought a male and a female herring. They towed them down to near Heidelberg and also brought a rock from the beach at low water. They released the herring and sunk the rock, and the herring began spawning. So now we can get herring roe from the Corley's Islands. In 1981, People from Heidelberg went and harvested herring roe on kelp. The Alaska State Department of Fish and Game arrested them, charged them with violations of subsistence law as well as fish and game regulations. And so now we're on quotas. We can only get 10 pounds per person. So after the herring egg, we normally go after seaweed. And I expect that pretty soon they're going to put a regulation that's going to restrict us to how much seaweed we can get once there's a commercial market for the seaweed. And also during this period of time, we would normally jig for halibut. But now, as you know, there's only a... I don't know if we have to yet or not, but we'll probably have to get permits to even go and jig for halibut to dry. And then later on in June, we'll begin getting sockeyes that we put up. And sockeye salmon has been the staple of the Haida diet since there were Haidas and salmon. But now, in order to get a few sockeyes, I have to get a permit to get 10 sockeyes, 10 per person. I'm not too sure the regulation has changed. And also the hunting regulations. When we're hungry, we went out and we got deer. Hungry, we went for fish. But now, with all these other regulations, we have lost virtually everything. The land is in jeopardy of being lost.